Hello， 大家好，我哋今日咧就好高兴请到一位重量级嘅嘉宾啦，就是、来自波兰嘅作者啦，Victor 沙博尔夫斯基。其实呢两本书咧系我非常非常喜欢。旧年咧我录过一个 chapter 咧，就关于呢一本书啦，《独裁者的厨师》呢一本咧就啱佢嘅新书啦，就专系讲俄罗斯嘅克里姆林宫的餐桌。咁但系当然即系作为国际关系嘅研究啦，就唔系净系讲即系饮食食啦，呢个系一个切入点啊。入边咧就好巧妙咁将厨师同埋呢個餐鋪啦，同埋呢個當時嘅國內形勢啦、國際形勢掛鈎，咁係 highly recommended 嘅。咁所以你而家就講下呢兩本書來龍去脈啦，同埋對我哋呢個地區啦、台灣、香港成個Great China 有咩嘅啟發啊 ？Victor， thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Actually, I like this one so much. So I spent two chapters of my programs to have it introduced last year, and this is the latest version, right? So maybe we start from the old one first, right? And what makes you so interested in this topic, the chefs, the dictators? It must be some cornerstone of the entire project, right?
Because I had a moment in my life when I was a chef myself, and it was a short moment, it was only a few months, but I kept in mind that the kitchen is amazing place, and professional kitchen, I mean. And the professional chefs are probably one of the most interesting professions in the world. That they know a lot of stories, they are usually very good storytellers, and that they are inspiring people, and they are people, it's good to be with them, it's interesting, there is always something going on. So then I gave up this, let's call it, cooking career, but I kept in mind that the world of kitchen, the culinary world is bizarre, is interesting. And then I began working as a journalist and writer, and I began covering the foreign and international issues, but I kept in mind that kitchen stories, and I was actually looking for a good culinary topic that I could cover, something I could write the book about. And then suddenly I saw a movie called Cooking History. It was a movie of a Slovak director, Peter Kerekes, who made a movie about chefs that work in the front lines. And that was amazing perspective. When you see a conflict, a war, and you see, usually we talk about generals, officers, you know, tactics, soldiers. And then when you listen a chef's story, they have such a different perspective, and it's so interesting. And in that movie, for the first time, I saw a dictator's chef, a guy who used to cook for Marshal Tito from Yugoslavia. And that was my wow moment. That was my, oh my God, this is so interesting. All the bloody tyrants, all the horrifying dictators had their chefs. What did they cook for them? So that was, shortly speaking, that's what happened.
As an international relations scholar, so I'm definitely more interested in the IR part than the food part, but I think that is a very interesting point to tap into the lives of these dictators. So are there any particular reasons that you would like to focus on these people because of their Polish background and your lives in the communist era, and what's the relevancy?
Why did they write about dictators, right?
Yeah, and whether you have some personal experience with them or...
Or why precisely about those dictators? Because why about those? I can say that this book was supposed to be the culinary history of the world, of dictatorship. That's the first layer. And the second was that sort of handbook of dictatorship. So that's a book who's trying to explain how dictators came to power, how they manipulate, how they lie, and if there is any way that we can protect ourselves. But if you ask about why did I start writing about dictators, why do I have interest in dictators, I think they are humanity in its extreme. It's dictatorship, you know, they have... We feed them. That's the second meaning of the title. The book is called How to Feed a Dictator, and the meaning is that we feed them. They are fed with our fears, with our frustration, And this is what I try to prove. And that was the most interesting part for me. So I don't think it has something in common that with my background, that I'm from a country that used to be communist. Mm-hmm. I rather think dictators are extremely interesting as a sort of humanity in its extreme version.
Mm-hmm. As you're from Poland, you also have some communist leaders, as you've mentioned. Do you consider them as dictators, or are they actually more human version of these kind of rulers?
The ones we had in Poland, right?
Yep.
Well, depends what definition of dictatorship you choose. Like, if any country where there is no free elections is a dictatorship, then yes, definitely they were dictators. We even had the martial law when the army took the power. And when we had this kind of junta with General Jaruzelski as the leader of it. But when you take the definition that to call somebody a dictator, there you need to have some, you know, gulags, political prisoners, some mass killings or things, mm-hmm. or these kind of things. There we had something I would probably call a semi-dictatorship.
So that's a definition of yours, right? Mass killings, gulag, and that is involving a gross violation of human rights.
I would say this is how I would try to define that. When I was looking for the dictators to this book, that was my definition, yeah.
Right. So among the many cases that you have mentioned, it seems that there are some intimate relations between the dictators and the chefs. And usually they don't trust anybody, but these people are highly trusted. And they taste for them, and they are the bodyguards for them, etc. So what are the particular reasons that led to these kind of relations?
I wouldn't agree that they were trusted, because when you are a dictator, you don't trust to anybody. That's the part of being a dictator, that you just don't trust to anyone. But in the world of the limited trust, they were somehow partly trusted. But still, each of the dictators had, except the chef, they had food testers. In the extreme case, Fidel Castro was the extreme case. They even built a special laboratory which had over 200 employees. And their only work was to check the food that was supposed to be served to Fidel and to the Politburo of Cuba. But I can agree that the relationship between dictators and their chefs was unique and much different than any other relation the dictators had. And I think it comes from the feeding itself. It's a very intimate thing. Usually, you know, the mother is your first feeder, and then every person who constantly, permanently feeds you becomes somehow close to you. And I think because it's like, you know, somehow the mother-child relationship is echoing with everyone mm-hmm. who's feeding you, especially for longer time. So I think it reflects in the relationship the dictators had with their chefs, that they could never trust them. They could never fully trust them, because they wouldn't be dictators if they trusted to anyone. But somehow they were close with their chefs, each of them.
Mm-hmm. Among the many cases that you have chosen, they were chosen as the chefs because of what reasons? The skills, the relations, and their political aspirations, or anything?
Well, there were two paths to become dictator's chef. One, probably the most natural, was that there is a revolution. You believe in that revolution, you believe in its values, you join it, and somehow you start cooking for the leader. Yeah, so that's shortly speaking. The good example of this path is the chef that used to cook for Fidel Castro, Erasmo Hernandez, who joined the revolution when he was only 16. And his first duty was, he was a bodyguard of Che Guevara. And actually he became Che Guevara's bodyguard because he was the shortest guy in the whole unit. And Che made him his bodyguard just for fun. He gave him the biggest rifle he had, and that was, you know, kind of joke. But then Che gave him to Fidel, and then, because he was driving with Fidel around all Cuba, that was after revolution won, and Fidel became the leader of the country. And he was always hungry, because Fidel was quite chaotic, and he never ate on time. Sometimes he didn't eat for, you know, 24 hours. He didn't have any meal. And the chef, he didn't like that. And he started cooking. Officially, he was cooking because he wanted Fidel to eat, but unofficially, he just wanted to eat himself. But that's path number one. You join the revolution, they trust you, and they make you cook for the leader. Path number two, is that the dictator already has the power, and each dictator has a moment when you think, okay, I won the revolution, I won the coup, or I just got the power, and I want to prove myself and check how much power I actually have. And then you just ask your people, find me the best chef in this damn country and make him cook for me. So that's the story of Abu Ali, the personal chef of Saddam Hussein, who was really the best chef in the country. He's amazing. His cooking skills are simply astonishing. No, astonishing is not the right word. He was just a master of cooking. And Saddam heard about him, and he forced him to cook for him. So that's basically two ways how you become dictator's chef.
And maybe the case about the Uganda dictator Idi Amin could be a slightly exceptional version, as he had been cooking for the previous dictator, and then he served a new one, and then he survived all these regimes. What's the secrets of his survival, according to your understanding?
You're talking about Otondo Odera, the guy who cooked firstly for Milton Obote. Then for Idi Amin, two dictators of Uganda, and was fired by the third one, by President Museveni. I think he was very smart, and he knew how to maneuver and how to avoid all the rifts holding this position. And when he was telling me about the coup that Idi Amin made against President Obote, he told me that all the people in the presidential palace were afraid that if Amin wins, he will ask to execute all the people from the presidential palace. But the chef, he was smart enough to say to the people, guys, we just have to work like it was a normal day, like we are not sided with anyone. And he prepared the best meal he could have prepared that day, and he served that meal on a beautiful plate with silver spoons, with silver forks and knives. So when Idi Amin finally, after the coup, came to the palace, the dinner was ready. And the chef told me that I knew that after a whole day of fights, he would be hungry. And if there would be no food, he would probably kill us. But because there was food, and the food was delicious, and the food was served on the most beautiful way that it could possibly be served, then Amin ate it, and he felt like a winner. So the chef made him feel like he won the coup. So nobody was killed, nobody was executed, Amin told to the personnel of the presidential palace, you guys just keep working. I don't have anything against you. As long as you're loyal, you'll be working in my palace.
Actually, that's the first chapter that I've chosen to read, because it's so juicy about Idi Amin, and there are a lot of gossips about him and human flesh and all these rumors. And as you've written, you have also asked about these rumors, whether that's accurate. But besides what the chef has told you, do you personally think that is possibly true. I mean, he is having the habits of hitting him afresh and using that to intimidate the enemies and all that.
I think if I answer this question, this will be a spoiler. And, and you know, the whole chapter is constructed this way that I will ruin the pleasure of people who will write this, who will read this book. But, well, to answer your question, I would say that in Idi Amin's Uganda, everything was possible. And I think that people who will read the book, they will have their own opinion. I have my own opinion, but I will keep it for myself. I think everybody after reading this chapter will know more or less what to think.
There's one thematic issue that is haunting my mind as always when I'm reading all along. Do you think these chefs are also conspiring with the dictators to torture their own people? If there's a cause or something like that, would they be found guilty?
I think it's like from the Hannah Arendt's book about the banality of evil, you know, that you can't really blame them. Like they didn't pull the trigger, right? They didn't shoot anyone. They didn't kill anyone. But at the same time, without a chef, there wouldn't be a dictator. Yeah. So I would say that they were a very small part in the huge machine of killing. But they were somehow they were responsible. Especially that some of them. Some of them, they couldn't give up their jobs, their positions, but some of them could easily give up. Like, they just had comfortable, easy life. And some of them might have been found as guilty.
I'm very interested in the story about Stalin's chefs and his half-brother, right?
Yeah. Would he be guilty? No, I think he was rather... He was rather the victim himself. I don't find any guilt in him. To tell a bit about the story, like he was most probably he was Stalin's half brother, and he had a little small business. He had a few restaurants in Tbilisi, which is the capital of Georgia, that back then in the Soviet Republic of Georgia, and because. The Soviets, they were at war with the private business, so they asked him to close the restaurant, and he was imprisoned. And so he kind of used his family, that his family used to befriend Stalin, and somehow he managed to send a message to Stalin that he's imprisoned. And Stalin not only asked to set him free, but also asked him to come to Moscow and see him. And that's how, step by step, he became Stalin's chef. And but from the very beginning, Stalin was the leader of the country, but Soviet Union had also a leader of the secret service of the country, and that was Beria. And Beria didn't like anybody to be close with Stalin. Beria wanted to decide who can befriend Stalin and who cannot. So Beria took it as a personal threat that there is somebody who's close with Stalin without asking for his permission. So the chef, he spent his whole years working very hard with devotion, but all this time his life was in danger. And all this time he had to fight with Beria, because Beria, he couldn't just openly come and kill him, but he could, you know, imprison his wife, imprison his children. He could kill his children, he could kill his wife. So, and he knew it. And I think his life was very dramatic. And there is no happy ending in this chapter, unfortunately.